Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize, maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So, do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Welcome to The Deep Dive, your shortcut to being truly well-informed, packed with surprising facts, and hopefully just enough humor to keep you hooked. Today we're embarking on a really deep dive into an area of law that honestly most people think is pretty simple, but it's actually incredibly intricate. Weapons offenses. You probably think a weapon is a weapon, you know.
Yeah.
Seems straightforward, right?
Right. That's the common sense view.
Exactly.
Okay.
But the legal definition, the precise rules around who can possess or carry one, and really crucially, where you can or cannot have it. Well, it's way more nuanced and complex than you'd probably assume.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine unknowingly stepping into a legal minefield just because your common perception didn't match up with the, like, super detailed legal reality. It happens, you know,
yeah,
more often than you'd think.
Yeah, that common misunderstanding is exactly why this topic is so important. The law doesn't really operate on assumptions or, you know, general feelings. It's built on meticulously defined terms and very, very specific conditions. Our deep dive today, I think, will really show the kind of precision needed in legal language and why it's just so critical for, well, for everyone to understand these nuances.
Absolutely. It's about getting you equipped with detailed knowledge to navigate this critical aspect of public and personal safety.
Exactly.
So our mission today is to demystify weapons offenses as they're laid out in Penal Code Chapter 46 of this particular legal framework.
Sure.
We've gone through a foundational document, a weapons student handout, pretty exhaustively. It outlines these critical laws in detail.
It's a solid base for understanding this stuff.
Think of this as your essential guide to grasping a complex and, frankly, often misunderstood area of law. We want to give you a clear, comprehensive understanding of what really constitutes a weapon in the eyes of the law, who can legally possess or carry one, and maybe most importantly, where and under what very specific conditions those prohibitions apply.
Right.
This deep dive is really for anyone who wants to be genuinely well-informed about weapons laws. Maybe you're a responsible firearm owner, maybe just a curious citizen trying to understand that balance between rights and restrictions, or maybe you just want to avoid, you know, accidental legal trouble.
Which is easy to do if you're not careful.
Totally. It's about equipping you with precise knowledge and hopefully some confidence in this area.
And it really is fundamental information. It touches on daily life, public safety, individual liberties. Understanding these intricate rules isn't just about avoiding trouble. It's about civic literacy, knowing your rights, knowing your responsibilities. It lets you operate confidently within the law, you know, make informed decisions that help keep you safe and your community safe, too.
Okay, so let's dive in. Let's lay the groundwork by tackling the most fundamental question. What precisely is a weapon in the eyes of the law? Because, as we're about to see, the legal definitions can be pretty different from what you might just casually assume.
Yeah, it's fascinating how carefully each term is defined in the Penal Code. And often, like you said, it even specifies what it is not, which is just as vital for legal clarity and, you know, how it's applied. This precision, it forces a really rigorous, critical look at the exact scope of these terms. It shows that legal definitions aren't really about common sense. They're about deliberate legislative choices.
Okay, let's start with one that seems simple but isn't. A club. Legally, a club is defined as an instrument that is specially designed, made, or adapted specifically for inflicting serious bodily injury or death by striking someone.
Right.
The law even gives examples. Right. Blackjack, nightstick, mace, even a tomahawk.
And that word adapted is so crucial there. It immediately brings up the question, you know, does the context and the intent behind modifying something matter more than what it originally was?
Right, like a baseball bat.
Exactly. A baseball bat normally is sports gear, not a weapon under this definition. But let's say someone takes that bat, wraps it in barbed wire, maybe adds some weights, with the clear intent to use it to seriously hurt someone by hitting them.
Then it's been adapted.
Precisely. The law sees it as adapted for that harmful purpose. It transforms a benign object into a prohibited club. So the law isn't just looking at the object's original form. It's really probing its intended purpose and any modification if the goal is serious harm. It can turn something innocent into something legally dangerous.
That distinction, intent and adaptation, that's huge.
Yeah.
Really highlights how almost anything could become a weapon legally. Okay, moving on. Let's unpack chemical dispensing devices.
Okay.
The definition is a device designed, made, or adapted for dispensing a substance that causes an adverse psychological or physiological effect on a human being.
Pretty broad. Oh,
it sounds broad, yeah. But there's a key exclusion most people probably rely on without thinking about the law.
Which it does not include a small chemical dispenser sold commercially for personal protection.
Ah, so like standard pepper spray someone might carry.
Exactly. That little can you buy at the store for self-defense. The law distinguishes between that, intended for individual protection, and, say, larger devices designed for crowd control or more widespread harm. So the line isn't just the chemical, it's about the device's design purpose, its size, and whether it's sold commercially for personal defense, a big tear gas grenade. That definitely falls under the prohibited definition.
Got it. Okay, explosives. This gets really detailed in the code. There are two main categories. Explosive weapon and improvised explosive device, or IED.
Right, distinct definitions.
An explosive weapon is defined broadly any explosive or incendiary bomb, grenade, rocket, or mine, designed or adapted for serious bodily injury, SBI, death, or substantial property damage. But here's a really interesting legal bit.
What's that?
It also includes devices designed for the principal purpose of causing such a loud report as to cause undue public alarm or terror.
Wow. So just making a loud bang to scare people can legally make it an explosive weapon, even without intending physical harm.
Seems like it. That public alarm part is a significant legal distinction.
Yeah.
And the definition also covers anything designed to, like, deliver or shoot an explosive weapon.
Okay. And how is an IED different then?
An improvised explosive device is defined very specifically. It's a completed and operational bomb designed for SBI, death, or substantial property damage, and it has to be fabricated in an improvised manner using non-military components.
Completed and operational. That seems key.
It is, and the law explicitly says what an IED is not. It's not just unassembled components you can legally buy and own without a license.
So buying fertilizer and pipes separately isn't automatically an IED?
Right. And crucially, it also excludes exploding targets used for firearms practice, the kind sold in kits with binary explosive components.
Yeah.
You know, the ones people use for recreational shooting.
Ah, okay. That makes sense. So it avoids criminalizing hobbyists or people buying common materials.
Exactly. The law seems to recognize that just having the raw parts doesn't make you a bomb maker. The key factors are whether it's completed, operational, improvised, and made from non-military parts. It really tries to target malicious intent, not innocent activities or just possessing materials.
That careful distinction is vital. It prevents the law from overreaching and, you know, accidentally criminalizing perfectly legal activities while still targeting the real danger of actual improvised bombs.
Okay, another interesting one. Hoax bomb. This is a device that meets one of two criteria. It reasonably appears to be an explosive or incendiary device.
So it just has to look real.
Right. Or B, by its design, it causes alarm or reaction from public safety or emergency volunteer agencies.
Hmm. So the focus there is purely on the appearance and the reaction it causes, not whether it could actually explode.
Exactly. You don't need a real bomb. You just need something that looks convincing enough or something designed in a way that triggers that emergency response and panic. The crime is in the deception and the disruption.
It highlights how disruptive and fear-inducing these things are, even if they're fake. It makes sense to prohibit that kind of behavior.
All right, let's get to the absolute bedrock of weapons laws. Firearms and handguns. A firearm is generally defined as any device designed, made, or adapted
to expel a projectile through a barrel using energy from explosion or burning substance. Or anything readily convertible to do that.
Seems pretty straightforward, covers most guns people think of.
It does, but there are some really significant, maybe surprising, exclusions. It specifically does not include antique or curio firearms manufactured before 1899.
Okay, so really old guns might not count.
Right. And it also excludes replicas of those pre-1899 firearms, but there's a catch. Only if the replica does not use modern rimfire or centerfire ammunition.
Ah, so the ammunition type is critical for replicas. If it uses modern bullets, it's probably treated as a modern firearm, even if it looks old.
That seems to be the implication. The age and the type of ammo are the key factors in defining what isn't considered a firearm under this specific code section. It seems like a way to respect historical artifacts as long as they don't use readily available modern ammo.
Yeah, it's a carve-out for historical pieces and collectibles, acknowledging their unique status. Makes sense. And handgun.
That one's simpler. Any firearm designed, made, or adapted to be fired with one hand. Pretty clear and really foundational for all the carrying laws we'll get into.
Okay.
Beyond those basics, the law defines some specialized firearms. A zip gun, for instance. That's described as a device or combination not originally a firearm, but adapted to shoot a projectile through a barrel using an explosion or burning substance.
So homemade or heavily modified guns, basically, things cobbled together.
Exactly. It targets those improvised firearms made outside the usual manufacturing process.
Okay. What about machine guns?
Machine gun is defined very meticulously. Any firearm capable of shooting more than two shots automatically without manual reloading by a single function of the trigger.
More than two shots automatically from one trigger pull? That's really precise.
It absolutely is. It clearly distinguishes true automatic fire, multiple shots per trigger pull, from semi-automatic fire, where you still need a separate trigger pull for each shot, no matter how fast you do it. That distinction is huge legally.
Yeah, massive implications for regulation and possession. And short barrel firearms. I know those have specific rules.
They do. Very specific measurements are key for compliance. It's defined as a rifle with a barrel less than 16 inches or a shotgun with a barrel less than 18 inches.
16 for rifles, 18 for shotguns. Okay.
It also covers any weapon made from a shotgun or rifle if, after it's altered, its overall length is less than 26 inches.
Less than 26 inches overall. Wow.
These exact measurements are crucial. Being off by even a tiny bit could make something illegal. It really demands precision from owners.
Yeah, no room for guesswork there. The law is clear on those numbers.
The code also defines armor-piercing ammunition. It's specified as handgun ammunition designed primarily to penetrate metal or body armor and to be used principally in pistols and revolvers.
So it's not just any bullet that happens to go through armor. It has to be specifically designed for that purpose, mainly for handguns.
That seems to be the focus, yes.
Yeah.
Its primary design and intended principal use are key.
Okay.
The term racetrack also gets a specific legal meaning, pulled from other state laws like the Texas Racing Act or the Occupations Code. This matters later when we talk about prohibited places, and it shows how terms in one law often rely on definitions set elsewhere.
Right. Legal definitions aren't always the common dictionary ones. They're specific to the statute.
And a tire deflation device, think caltrops or spike strips, is defined as something designed to impede or stop wheeled vehicles by puncturing tires. But there's an important exclusion.
What's that?
It doesn't include a traffic control device that only punctures tires going in one specific direction and has a clearly visible warning sign nearby.
Ah, like those things on freeway exits to stop wrong-way drivers?
Exactly. The distinction is about purpose and public notification. One is for traffic safety, clearly marked. The other is generally for malicious use.
Makes sense. Purpose matters.
The code also gets into personnel definitions, which is really important context for understanding who gets exemptions later on. Volunteer emergency services personnel is broad volunteer firefighters, EMS volunteers, others volunteering in emergencies. But it specifically excludes peace officers or reserve officers when they're doing law enforcement duties.
Okay, so volunteers are separate from sworn officers in this context.
Right. And first responder is defined very precisely as a public safety employee, keyword employee, whose duties include rapid emergency response, like fire or EMS. But again, it explicitly excludes volunteers, even EMS volunteers defined elsewhere, and also excludes peace officers or reserve officers doing law enforcement duties.
So paid versus volunteer seems to be a key distinction here, and also keeping law enforcement separate from other emergency roles for these definitions. Why such specific lines?
That's a great question. It almost certainly boils down to who can legally carry weapons in certain restricted circumstances. The distinctions likely relate to specific job roles, the level of training required, the authority they operate under, and maybe oversight. The law needs to be crystal clear about whose specific training and job responsibilities qualify them for special exemptions when it comes to carrying firearms.
Yeah, you can't have ambiguity there. The stakes are too high. It has to be based on specific, verifiable professional status, not just, you know, being involved in public service generally.
Exactly. And one last definition for this segment, felony. For the purpose of this chapter, chapter 40.
Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize, maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So, do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
An offense counts as a felony if it's designated a felony by the state, or it have all the legal elements of a state felony, or it's punishable by a year or more in a penitentiary.
Okay, pretty standard definitions.
But here's the catch.
Yeah.
An offense is not considered a felony for these purposes if it doesn't meet both the state designation and the element criteria.
Interesting. So an out-of-state conviction called a felony might not actually count as a felony under this specific Texas law if it doesn't perfectly match up with Texas's definition and elements.
That seems to be the implication. It prevents an overly broad application, making sure the consequences, especially regarding weapon possession, are based strictly on offenses that align with the state's own legal framework, not just a label from somewhere else.
That ensures consistency within the state's laws. Okay, that's a lot of definitions, but really crucial groundwork.
Absolutely. So now that we've sort of wrestled with the intricate legal definitions of what weapons are, let's shift gears. Let's talk about the specific actions and circumstances that actually lead to an offense. This is where it gets maybe even more detailed, because the laws really hinge on who you are and where you are. It's not just about the object anymore. Your legal history, your status, your location, they all become critical factors.
Yeah, this part really drives home the importance of an individual's history and current legal standing. It's not just about the weapon, it's the whole legal context around the person holding it. It forces you to think critically about your own legal obligations and how past actions can create really significant, lasting restrictions.
Let's start with unlawful possession of a firearm, Section 46.04. This primarily deals with people who have a felony conviction. If you've been convicted of a felony, possessing a firearm is an offense under two different timelines, basically.
Okay.
First, it's illegal if it's before the fifth anniversary of your release from confinement or supervision or parole, whichever date is the latest. During that five-year window, possessing a firearm anywhere is illegal. Full stop.
Right. A complete prohibition for that initial period.
But even after that five-year period is up, the right to possess isn't fully restored. Possession is still unlawful at any location other than the premises where the person lives.
Wow. So even years later, a felon can basically only have a firearm in their own home. They can't take it anywhere else, like to the range or hunting.
That seems to be the rule under this section. Having it at home might be okay after 5 years, but possession anywhere else could still be a felony. And the penalty for this is typically a third-degree felony, which is serious.
That's a significant long-term restriction.
Definitely. This section also targets other groups. For instance, it's an offense for a member of a criminal street gang if they intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly carry a handgun on or about their person, meaning on them, or easily reachable while they're in a motor vehicle or a watercraft.
So a specific rule just for gang members in vehicles.
Right. And the penalty for that is a Class A misdemeanor. It's a specific prohibition aimed at gang activity involving firearms.
Okay. What else?
There are also restrictions for people convicted of a Class A misdemeanor assault involving a family or household member. If you have that kind of conviction, it's an offense to possess a firearm before the fifth anniversary of your release from confinement or community supervision.
Another 5-year prohibition, specifically tied to domestic violence convictions.
Exactly. That's aimed at protecting victims and carries a Class A misdemeanor penalty.
Makes sense.
And maybe most critically, for people subject to protective orders. It's an offense if a person, after they've received official notice of a protective order, possesses a firearm before that order expires. This is a huge safety measure.
Absolutely vital.
But there's a very specific, important exception here. This prohibition does not apply to a peace officer who is actively engaged in their job as a sworn, full-time paid employee of a state agency or political subdivision.
Right. And that exception seems critical, doesn't it? Why is that carve-out for active duty officers so important?
Well, imagine the impact on public safety. If police officers who need firearms to do their jobs were suddenly disarmed because of a protective order, even if it's unrelated to their work conduct, it allows law enforcement to continue functioning while the issues behind the protective order are handled through other channels. It's about ensuring they can still perform their duties.
Yeah, it enables them to do their job safely. Disarming active officers would be a huge public safety issue. The penalty for violating the protective order firearm ban is also a Class A misdemeanor.
Yeah, just to clarify some terms used in this section, premises gets a specific, broader meaning here. Includes real property, obviously, but also includes a recreational vehicle if it's being used as living quarters, whether that's temporary or permanent.
So your RV counts as your home for this law, basically.
If you're living in it, yes.
Yeah.
And recreational vehicle is also defined pretty broadly. Travel trailers, camping trailers, truck campers, motorhomes, even horse trailers if they have living quarters built in. So your mobile living space can count as your premises.
Okay, that's good clarification. And watercraft.
Watercraft is also broad. Any boat, motorboat, vessel, or personal watercraft used or capable of being used for transport on water. The only thing excluded is a seaplane when it's actually on the water. Again, these precise definitions aim to remove any ambiguity.
Got it. Okay, that covers unlawful possession. What about unlawful carrying?
Okay.
Section 46.02.
Right, let's dive into unlawful carrying weapons. Section 46.02. This is incredibly detailed. Generally, you commit an offense if you intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly carry a handgun on or about your person, AD. At that time, you meet one of two conditions.
Okay, what are they?
One, you're younger than 21 years old. Or two, you've been convicted within the last 5 years of certain specific offenses. Those include Class A assault, deadly conduct, terroristic threat, or specific types of disorderly conduct, like shooting a gun in public or displaying a weapon to alarm someone.
So under 21 or a recent conviction for those specific crimes generally means no carrying a handgun in public.
Generally, yes. But there are absolutely vital exceptions. This prohibition doesn't apply if you are on your own premises or premises under your control. Recognizes your right in your own space.
Right, the Castle Doctrine idea.
Kind of. Mm. And it also doesn't apply if you are inside of or directly en route to a motor vehicle or watercraft that you own or that's under your control.
Okay. So transport to and from your home or vehicle is generally allowed, even if you fall into one of those prohibited categories.
That's what the exception suggests, yeah. It carves out your personal space in the act of getting to and from it.
Okay, critical exceptions. Now, what about carrying specifically in a vehicle or watercraft?
Good question. It becomes an offense if the handgun is in plain view, unless one of two things is true. The person is 21 or older, or the person is licensed to carry a handgun and the handgun is carried in a holster.
Okay, wait. So if I'm 21 or older but not licensed, I can have a handgun in plain view in my car without a holster. That seems counterintuitive. Let me reread that part of the outline. Ah, I see the nuance in the outline's phrasing now. It's an offense if it's in plain view, unless you're 21 plus or licensed and it's in a holster. The way the outline phrased it initially made it seem like just being 21 plus was an exception to plain view, but the actual text likely connects the holster requirement more broadly. Let's assume the statute requires a holster for plain view carry in a vehicle for everyone who isn't otherwise prohibited, or maybe links the 21 plus exception to concealed carry within the vehicle. This needs careful reading of the actual statute text, but for our discussion, let's focus on the clear rule. A licensed carrier must use a holster if the gun is in plain view in the vehicle. An unholstered gun on the seat is likely trouble.
Right. The holster seems key for plain view in a vehicle if you're licensed. And it's also an offense to carry in the vehicle if you're engaged in criminal activity other than like a basic traffic ticket or a boating violation or a DLR, if you're prohibited by law from possessing a firearm anyway.
So doing another crime while carrying escalates things significantly. Makes sense.
The law also specifically addresses intentionally displaying a handgun in plain view in a public place. It's an offense if you carry a handgun and intentionally show it off in plain view of someone else in public.
Okay, so just walking around with it out.
Yeah, but here's the crucial exception, again, for licensed carriers. It's not an offense if the handgun was partially or wholly visible, but was carried in a holster.
Ah, so the holster makes open carry legal in public for licensed individuals, even if people can see the gun. The holster signifies it's being carried securely, not brandished.
That seems to be the legal distinction, yes. The holster changes the legality of that plain view display in public for those licensed to carry.
Interesting nuance. What about carrying while intoxicated?
Big no-no. It's an offense if you carry a handgun while intoxicated AD. You're not on your own property or property under your control or private property with the owner's permission, or inside of or directly en route to your vehicle, watercraft, or one you have permission to be in.
And intoxicated means?
Substantial impairment of mental or physical capacity resulting from the introduction of any substance into the body. So alcohol, drugs, whatever causes that impairment.
Right. Combining impairment with firearms is obviously a huge public safety risk the law wants to prevent.
Absolutely. Now, there's another critical offense, carrying while prohibited from possessing. This can be a stackable offense, meaning they can charge you with this on top of other crimes.
How does this work?
It's an offense if you carry a handgun and you're already legally prohibited from possessing a firearm under those sections we talked about earlier, 46.04A, B, or C. It's felons, people with family violence convictions, or people under protective orders. And you're not on your own premises or en route to your own vehicle, watercraft.
So someone who's already banned from even having a gun commits an even more serious offense if they're caught carrying it outside their home or vehicle.
Exactly. And the penalties here jump significantly. While most unlawful carrying is the Class A misdemeanor, if you were prohibited because of a felony conviction, 36.04A, carrying becomes a second-degree felony with a mandatory minimum sentence of 5 years in prison.
Wow, 5 years minimum just for carrying it when you're a felon.
Yes, and if you were prohibited because of family violence, 46.04B, or a protective order, 46.04C, carrying becomes a third-degree felony.
That's a massive escalation in penalty. Why so much harsher?
It reflects the extreme seriousness of defying an existing legal prohibition, especially for individuals already identified as posing a higher risk.
Yeah.
It sends a very clear message. If you're already legally barred from having a gun, carrying one carries incredibly severe consequences.
A very strong deterrent message from the legislature there.
Definitely. And finally, for this carrying section, there's unlawful carrying of location-restricted knives by minors. It's an offense if someone intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly carries a location-restricted knife on or about their person, and they're under 18 years old.
What counts as a location-restricted knife?
Specifically, a knife with a blade over 5.5 inches. And knife itself is defined broadly as any bladed hand instrument capable of causing SBI or death by cutting or stabbing. So that blade length is the key factor for minors.
Over 5.5 inches is the line. Are there exceptions for minors?
Yes, common sense ones. It doesn't apply if they're on their own premises or premises under their control, inside or directly en route to a vehicle or watercraft they own or control, or crucially, if they are under the direct supervision of a parent or legal guardian.
Okay, so supervised activities like hunting or camping might be okay.
Right. It acknowledges legitimate uses under supervision, but restricts general public carrying of large knives by unsupervised minors. The penalty for this is a Class C misdemeanor.
Got it. That covers who can't possess or carry and how. Now, where are weapons absolutely off limits, the restricted zones?
Exactly. We've defined weapons, covered who can't carry them. Now, let's talk about where you absolutely cannot carry certain weapons, often regardless of your personal status or even if you have a license. This is section 46.603, places weapons prohibited, and it's incredibly detailed. Understanding these restricted zones is absolutely vital for compliance. Ignorance here is definitely not bliss.
Right. This part of the law designates specific places where having weapons is seen as especially hazardous or just plain inappropriate. The reasons vary: public safety, the vulnerability of people there, like in schools or hospitals, or the function of the place, like a court or polling place. You really have to pay close attention to the differences between types of places and, critically, the notice requirements we'll get into.
Let's start with educational institutions. There's a very broad general prohibition. You cannot possess or go with a firearm, location-restricted knife, club, or other prohibited weapon on the premises of a public or private school or a post-secondary educational institution.
Premises meaning the buildings mainly.
We'll get to the definition, but it also covers grounds or buildings under their control where they're having a sponsored activity, or even in their buses or vans. It's pretty comprehensive.
Okay. Are there exceptions?
Yes. Carrying is allowed if it's done pursuant to written regulations or authorization from the school or institution, so they can allow it under specific circumstances.
And what about colleges versus K-12? Is there a difference?
Big difference. Specifically for post-secondary educational institutions.
Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So, do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Institutions, colleges, universities, a person licensed to carry a handgun can possess or go with a concealed handgun, but not other weapons from this section, on the premises, grounds, buildings, during sponsored activities, or in their passenger vehicles.
Ah, so concealed carry by licensed individuals is generally allowed on college campuses, but not necessarily in K-12 schools unless there's specific written permission.
That's the key distinction. The rules are much stricter for K-12. Concealed carry is specifically addressed and more broadly permitted at the higher education level, reflecting a different approach.
Okay. And how is premises defined for schools? You mentioned that.
Right, this is crucial. For educational institutions, premises means a building or a portion of a building. Mm-hmm. And here's the part that surprises people. It does not include any public or private driveway, street, sidewalk or walkway, parking lot, parking garage, or other parking area.
Wow. So the restriction is basically just inside the school building itself, not the parking lot or the sidewalk right next to it.
Generally, yes. That's a huge distinction. You could potentially be legally carrying in the parking lot, walk across the sidewalk, but the second you step inside the school building door, you could be violating the law, unless you have that specific authorization or, for colleges, a license to carry concealed. Knowing exactly where the building line is becomes critical.
That highlights the incredibly granular nature of these laws. A few feet can make all the difference.
Absolutely. And even for licensed handgun holders on college campuses where concealed carry might be allowed, there are still specific offenses. Even with a license, it's an offense to carry a handgun, even partially visible, and intentionally or knowingly display it in plain view of someone else. This applies on the premises and on any driveway, street, parking lot, etc. of the institution.
So even if concealed carry is okay inside, open display, even in the parking lot, is generally not okay for a licensed carrier on college property.
That's what it says. It seems aimed at preventing overt displays in that academic setting.
Okay. What about private colleges? Can they ban guns entirely?
Yes. It's an offense for a license holder to carry a handgun, concealed or not, on a private or independent higher education campus if that institution has established rules prohibiting licensed carry. And D. This is key. They give effective notice using the specific signage required by Section 30.06.
So private schools can opt out, but they have to post the correct legal signs.
Correct. And for public institutions, they can also designate specific portions of the campus where concealed carry is prohibited by their rules. Again, it's only an offense for a license holder to carry there if the institution gives that same effective notice under 30.06 for that specific area.
So public universities can create gun-free zones within the campus, but again, only if they post the proper signs for those specific zones.
Exactly. The penalties for these specific higher education offenses are generally a Class A misdemeanor. It shows that while license carry is broadly allowed on public campuses, institutions still have some control if they follow the strict notice rules.
That balance between state law and institutional control, all hinging on proper notice. Fascinating. Okay, what about other public spaces?
Right, governmental and public spaces. Weapons are generally prohibited on the premises of a polling place on election day or during early voting. Pretty straightforward, protects the voting process.
Makes sense.
Also, on the premises of any government court or offices used by the court, unless the court itself gives written authorization, keeps courts secure. And on the premises of a racetrack.
Okay, courts, polling places, racetracks. Got it. Are there defenses for those?
Yes, for official duties. If you're military, National Guard, a prison guard, or an officer of the court, carrying as part of your job is a defense. And for racetracks specifically, commissioned security officers in uniform with a weapon in plain view while on duty or traveling to from have a defense.
So legitimate security is covered. What about airports? Always tricky.
Very tricky and highly regulated. The prohibition is for being in or into a secured area of an airport. Now, what's a secured area?
Yeah, what does that mean legally? Pass security.
Exactly. It's the area of the terminal building where access is controlled by TSA screening under federal law,
mm-hmm.
or an aircraft parking area used by commercial airlines, not general aviation, where access is federally controlled.
Okay, so basically past the TSA checkpoint or out on the tarmac where the big planes park.
Right. But crucially, the definition excludes common public areas. Baggage claim, passenger and employee parking lots, public pickup, and drop-off zones.
So you're generally okay in the main lobby, ticketing, baggage claim, parking garage. The prohibition only starts once you go through security screening.
That's the line the law draws. It's about the truly restricted, federally controlled zones.
Okay. What if you have a gun and need to fly or make a mistake?
There are defenses. One is checking the firearm as baggage, according to all the federal and airline rules, before you enter the secured area. That's the standard procedure.
Right. Declare it, check it properly.
Another defense is if you were specifically authorized by a federal agency or the airport operator to have the firearm there, think maybe federal air marshals or specific security roles. And here's a really important one for licensed carriers. It's a defense if you possess a handgun, you're licensed to carry at the screening checkpoint, and you immediately exit the checkpoint area once they finish screening you and tell you you have it.
Ah, so if you just forgot it was in your carry-on, and TSA finds it, you can just leave the checkpoint area immediately without being arrested.
That's exactly what this defense allows. It provides a way to fix an honest mistake for licensed carriers without facing immediate charges, as long as you comply and leave right away.
That's a very practical and, frankly, humane provision for an easy mistake to make.
It is, and law even tells peace officers how to handle this. An officer investigating this situation at a checkpoint cannot arrest the licensed carrier unless they first advise the person about this immediate exit defense, give them a chance to leave, and the person refuses to leave immediately.
So it mandates a warn and let them leave approach first for licensed carriers.
Yes. It prioritizes compliance and rectifying the mistake over immediate arrest for licensed individuals in that specific scenario.
That's a really interesting balance between security and recognizing accidental violations by otherwise law-abiding people.
Definitely. Okay, moving on to other highly sensitive restricted locations. Within 1,000 feet of a place of execution on the day a sentence is carried out, if you receive notice. But there are exceptions for just driving by on a public road or being at your home or work if it's within that zone. Official duties are also a defense.
Okay. Execution sites. What else?
Premises of a business that gets 51% or more of its income from selling alcohol for on-site consumption. Think bars, basically. These usually have a clear 51% sign posted.
Right. The 51% rule. Alcohol and firearms generally don't mix legally there.
Also, premises where a high school, collegiate, or professional sporting event or interscholastic event is happening. The exception is if you're a participant and the weapon is used in the event, like for a starting pistol or maybe a historical reenactment halftime show.
Okay. Sporting events generally off limits.
Correctional facilities, prisons, jails, civil commitment facilities, licensed hospitals and nursing facilities, and mental hospitals, unless you get written permission from the facility administration.
Those make sense. Vulnerable populations or secure environments?
Amusement parks. But the definition here is very specific and narrow.
How so?
It has to be a permanent park in a county with over 1 million people, be at least 75 acres, enclosed with controlled entry, open more than 120 days a year, and have security guards always present. And again, it excludes driveways, parking lots, sidewalks, etc.
Wow, that's incredibly specific. So it only applies to really large, major theme parks in populous counties, not just any local carnival or smaller park.
That seems to be the intent. It's a very strict definition. And finally, in the room or rooms where an open meeting of a governmental entity is being held, if they've posted the required notice.
Okay, protects public government meetings. Now, the penalties for violating these prohibited places rules,
they vary. Generally, violating 46.03 is a third-degree felony, serious time. But if the weapon was a location-restricted knife, it's usually just a Class C misdemeanor, like a traffic ticket. The big exception is if you bring that knife into an educational institution, then it jumps back up to a third-degree felony.
So knives in schools are treated much more seriously.
Yes. And several other locations have a lower penalty, a Class A misdemeanor, that applies to offenses committed at sporting events, civil commitment facilities, hospitals, nursing facilities, mental hospitals, amusement parks, as defined, and those specific handgun offenses for licensed carriers at colleges we talked about.
Why the different penalty levels? Class A versus third degree felony.
It likely reflects the legislature's assessment of the perceived danger or sensitivity of each specific location. Schools and courts might be seen as needing the highest protection, hence the felony, while other places, while still restricted, might warrant a serious misdemeanor instead. It's a tiered approach based on the perceived risk.
A hierarchy of sensitive places reflected in the penalties. Makes sense. Okay, we've covered a ton on definitions, who can't carry and where they can't carry. What's left?
We've covered a lot, you're right. But the legal landscape goes even deeper. There are still specific rules about types of weapons that are just flat-out prohibited, rules about how weapons are transferred or sold, and a really critical responsibility regarding securing firearms from children.
Okay.
And just as important as all the prohibitions are, the many, many exceptions and non-applicability clauses. This final segment is really about understanding that whole intricate web of rights, responsibilities, and exceptions. It reveals layers of detail most people probably never even think about.
Yeah, this last part is crucial for the full picture. It rounds out the offenses related to specific weapon types and actions, but maybe more importantly, it lays out that huge list of non-applicability situations. These exceptions are where the law acknowledges all the different roles and contexts, and it really makes you think critically about who gets exempted and why those exemptions are necessary.
Let's start with prohibited weapons under Section 46.05. This makes it a serious offense to intentionally or knowingly possess, make, transport, repair, or sell certain specific items.
What items fall under this?
Explosive weapons, machine guns, and short barrel firearms. Those are generally prohibited unless the specific item is properly registered under federal law, the National Firearms Registration and Transfer Record, or it's not subject to registration, or it's classified as a curio or relic by the DOJ.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a path for legal regulated ownership of some of these.
Okay, so not an absolute ban if you follow the very strict federal rules. What else is prohibited?
Armor-piercing ammunition. Chemical dispensing devices, with an exception we'll get to, zip guns, tire deflation devices, and improvised explosive devices, IEDs.
So basically, items deemed inherently dangerous or commonly used for crime, mostly banned for private citizens.
General, yes, but there are defenses. Official duty for military, law enforcement, prison guards is a defense. Dealing with a short barrel firearm or tire deflation device solely as an antique or curio is a defense.
Allows for collecting historical items.
Right. And dealing with armor-piercing ammo or tire deflation devices solely to provide them to official agencies is also a defense. Ensure supply for those who need them legally.
Okay. And the chemical dispensing device exception?
Yes. There's a specific defense for security officers if they've received state-approved training from TECO or the Private Security Board on how to use it properly.
So trained security can use things like pepper spray canisters that might be larger than the personal defense ones.
That seems to be the idea. Ensures proper training for professional use. Penalties for these prohibited weapons are generally a third-degree felony, but possessing a tire deflation device is a state jail felony. Slightly less severe, but still a felony.
Got it.
Next, Section 46.041, unlawful possession of metal or body armor by felon. Metal or body armor is defined as anybody covering clearly designed or adapted to protect against gunfire.
Like a bulletproof vest.
Exactly. It's an offense if someone convicted of any felony possesses this kind of armor after their conviction. No time limit mentioned here, unlike the firearm possession rule.
So a lifetime ban on body armor for anyone with a felony conviction.
That's how it reads. The penalty is a third-degree felony.
Why prohibit body armor for felons?
The rationale is likely to prevent individuals already deemed higher risk due to a felony conviction from equipping themselves in a way that could make confrontations with law enforcement more dangerous or drawn out. It limits their ability to both possess firearms after the initial period and protect themselves from gunfire.
A preventative measure focused on potential future confrontations. Okay, what about transferring weapons?
Section 46.06, unlawful transfer of certain weapons. This covers a lot of scenarios trying to keep weapons out of the wrong hands. It's illegal to sell, rent, loan, or give a handgun to someone if you know they plan to use it unlawfully.
Okay, knowingly facilitating a crime.
Right. Also, intentionally or knowingly selling, renting, leasing, giving, or even just offering any firearm, club, or location-restricted knife to any child younger than 18.
Strict prohibition on providing those weapons to minors.
Yes. Also illegal. Intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly selling a firearm or ammo to someone who is clearly intoxicated.
Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize, maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So, do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Knowingly selling a firearm or ammo to a convicted felon before that 5-year anniversary of their release we discussed. Selling, renting, loaning, or giving a handgun to someone you know has an active protective order against them.
Reinforcing those possession prohibitions by cutting off the supply side, too.
Exactly. And conversely, it's illegal for someone subject to an active protective order to knowingly purchase, rent, lease, or receive a handgun from someone else.
And so it cuts both ways on protective orders.
Yes. And finally, a big one. If you're already prohibited from possessing a firearm, it's illegal to knowingly make a material false statement on a required form when trying to buy one from a licensed dealer.
Right.
Lying on the background check form, basically.
Right, trying to cheat the system. Are there defenses for transferring to minors? What about parents giving guns to kids for hunting?
Yes, there's a key affirmative defense. It's okay if the transfer was to a minor whose parent or legal guardian gave written permission for a sale or gave effective consent for a non-sale transfer, like a gift or loan.
So parental permission is the key. Why structure it that way?
It clearly acknowledges the parent's authority and responsibility. It allows for legitimate supervised activities like hunting or target shooting initiated by the parent while still prohibiting unauthorized transfers to minors.
Makes sense. Penalties for unlawful transfers.
Generally, Class A misdemeanors. However, it bumps up to a state jail felony if the weapon transferred to the child was a handgun, specifically, or if the offense was lying on that firearm purchase form.
So higher penalties for giving handguns to kids or lying on the form, reflecting greater concern about those specific acts.
Precisely. Okay, quick ones. Section 46.08, hoax bombs. It's illegal to knowingly make, sell, buy, transport, or possess a hoax bomb with the intent to either make someone believe it's real or cause alarm or reaction from emergency services. That's a Class A misdemeanor.
Reinforces the idea that causing fear and disruption is the crime, even if it's fake.
Section 46.09, components of explosives. Illegal to knowingly possess components of an explosive weapon with the intent to combine them into one for use in a criminal endeavor. That's a third-degree felony. The key is the criminal intent behind having the parts.
Targets the preparation for bomb-making with criminal intent.
Now, a penalty enhancer. Section 46.11, penalty if offense committed within weapon-free school zone. This increases the punishment for any offense in this chapter to the next highest category if the actor committed it in a place they knew was within 300 feet of a school's premises or on premises where an official school function or UIL event was happening.
Wow, a 300-foot bubble around schools dramatically increases the penalty for any weapons offense.
Yes. School here means K-12, private or public. This enhancement specifically doesn't apply to offenses on higher education premises under 46.03A1, as they have their own penalty structure.
That's a significant enhancement, really emphasizing school safety.
Definitely. Now, Section 46.13, making a firearm accessible to a child. This is critical. You commit an offense if a child defined as under 17 gets access to a readily dischargeable firearm, and you acted with criminal negligence by either failing to secure it or leaving it where you knew or should have known a child could get it.
Places a clear duty on gun owners regarding kids. What's readily dischargeable?
It means it's loaded with ammunition, whether or not there's a round in the chamber. And secure means taking reasonable steps, like using a locked container, safe, locked box, or a trigger lock.
Okay, clear definitions for responsible storage. Are there defenses? What about supervised shooting?
Yes, important affirmative defenses. It's not an offense if the child's access was supervised by someone 18 plus for lawful purposes like hunting or sport, or if the child accessed it for lawful self-defense, or if the child got access by trespassing or committing another crime to get to the gun, or if it happened while the owner was engaged in agriculture, where guns might be working tools.
Covers legitimate scenarios and focuses on negligent storage. Penalties.
Generally a Class E misdemeanor. But it becomes a Class A misdemeanor if the child actually discharges the firearm and causes death or serious bodily injury to anyone. A much heavier penalty if tragedy occurs.
Understandable escalation.
And there's a public awareness piece. Firearms dealers must post a conspicuous sign, big block letters at least an inch high, warning customers it's unlawful to store or leave unsecured firearms where kids can get them.
So, legal responsibility combined with public education.
Right. Then Section 46.14, firearms smuggling. This targets the illicit trafficking business. It's illegal to knowingly engage in the business of transporting or transferring firearms, you know, were illegally acquired.
What counts as engaging in the business?
Doing it more than once, or doing it for profit or any other kind of payment. It targets a pattern of activity, not just a single instance.
Focuses on organized trafficking.
Penalty.
Third-degree felony. But it jumps to a second-degree felony if the offense involved three or more firearms in one criminal episode. Again, higher penalty for larger-scale operations, exception for peace officers on duty. Okay, targets the bigger players in illegal gun trade.
Exactly. Now, finally, the big one. Section 46.15, critical non-applicability exceptions. This lists tons of people in situations where the main unlawful carrying, 46.02, and places prohibited, 46.03 laws, just do not apply. This is where the real complexity nuance live.
Right. This is where the law acknowledges all the necessary exceptions for society to function. Who gets exempted? It's a long list.
It's extensive.
Yeah.
Let's break it down. First, general exemptions, where 46.02 carrying and 46.03 places don't apply.
Okay.
Lots of law enforcement and judicial folks. Peace officers, special investigators, can carry anywhere, on or off duty. Parole officers, on duty, following policy. Community supervision probation officers, on duty, authorized. Active or retired judges, justices, if licensed to carry. Honorably retired peace officers, with current proficiency certain, ID. Certain attorneys, AG, USDA, county, municipal, if licensed. Assistant attorneys in those offices, if licensed. Bailiffs escorting a judge, if licensed. Authorized juvenile probation officers.
A broad umbrella covering the justice system personnel who often need to be armed.
Yes. Also exempt. Volunteer emergency services personnel, if licensed and actively providing services. First responders, paid firefighter CMS, with specific training cert, on duty, carrying concealed or holstered.
Recognizes the roles of volunteers and first responders in emergencies.
Right. Now, there's another set of exemptions that apply to 46.02, carrying, 46.03A14, government meetings, and 46.04A1, gang members in vehicle. These don't apply to military members or prison guards on duty.
Okay.
A person who is traveling, this is a big general exemption. Lawful hunting, fishing, or other sporting activity, if the weapon is common for that activity and you're on the premises or going to from.
Allows for transport for recreation and general travel?
Security personnel. Mm-hmm. Commissioned security officers. On duty traveling, in uniform, weapon visible. Personal protection officers, on duty traveling, either uniform visible or plain clothes concealed.
Covers the security industry's needs.
And a huge one. A person with a license to carry a handgun, if the handgun is carried concealed or in a holster. This is the general bedrock principle for licensed carry. It exempts you from the basic unlawful carrying offense and some prohibited places, unless a more specific rule applies.
That's the core of licensed carry rights.
Also exempt, alcohol permit holders, employees supervising the premises, law enforcement students in class with unloaded common weapons.
Okay, practical exceptions. What about disasters?
Yes, crucial disaster exemptions for 46.02. Carrying. You can carry a handgun while evacuating from or re-entering a declared disaster area for up to 168 hours or longer if extended, if you're not otherwise prohibited by law from having a gun.
Allows for self-protection during emergencies.
And you can carry in an emergency shelter during a disaster if the operator allows it. You follow the rules and you're not otherwise prohibited.
Addresses temporary living and shelters.
There are also exemptions for historical events. The rule about miners and large knives doesn't apply if the knife is part of a historical demonstration. And several carrying prohibited place rules don't apply if you're carrying a handgun as part of a historical reenactment following TVC rules.
Protects historical and cultural activities.
Okay, now the really critical part of 46.15. Notice related defenses and applicability, specifically for 46.03, places prohibited. This is all about how property owners communicate bans, especially to licensed carriers.
Right. How do you know if a place is legally off limits to you if you have a license?
There's a defense called a prompt departure defense. If you're carrying a handgun where it's prohibited under 46.03, but you personally received notice, like someone told you, and you promptly departed, that can be a defense to prosecution.
So if you genuinely didn't know and you leave immediately when told, you might be okay.
It suggests that possibility. However, this defense does not work if either. One, a specific, legally compliant, no weapon sign was properly posted at each entrance. Or two, you already knew carrying was prohibited there. Maybe you were told before, or it's obvious, like a courthouse.
Ah, so proper signage or prior knowledge overrides that, oops, I'll leave now, defense.
Exactly. Which brings us to the requirements for that sign. To provide legally effective notice under 46.03, the sign must be posted at each entrance and meet very specific criteria.
What are they?
It has to include language identical or substantially similar to, pursuant to Section 46.03, Penal Code, places weapons prohibited. A person may not carry a firearm or other weapon on this property. It must have that language in both English and Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
It must be in contrasting colors with block letters at least 1 inch high, and it has to be displayed conspicuously, clearly visible to the public.
Wow, that's incredibly specific. English and Spanish, contrasting colors, 1 inch letters, conspicuous at every entrance. A simple little sticker won't cut it legally.
Likely not, based on these requirements. The burden is really on the property owner to provide this exact, legally binding notice if they want to enforce the 46.03 prohibition against someone who might otherwise be legally carrying.
That puts a high bar on property owners to properly communicate the restriction.
It does. And there's one more layer for licensed carriers. For certain specific locations, the 51% bars, A7, hospitals, nursing facilities, A11, and amusement parks, A13, the prohibition under 46.03 does not apply to a person with an LTC carrying a handgun if they were not given effective notice under the other notice statutes, sections 30.06 for concealed carry, or 30.07 for open carry, or government code 411.204.
Wait, so for bars, hospitals, and amusement parks, even if they're listed in 46.03, a licensed carrier might still be able to carry if the specific 30.06 or 30.07 signs aren't posted?
That seems to be the implication. For those specific places, the law points licensed carriers towards the signage rules specifically designed for them, 30.0630.07, not just the general 46.03 sign. Similarly, for collegiate sporting events, A8, the 46.03 prohibition doesn't apply to an LTC holder carrying a handgun if they weren't given effective 30.06 or 30.07 notice.
That is incredibly nuanced. It means for licensed carriers, the legality of carrying in places like bars, hospitals, amusement parks, and college games often hinges entirely on whether the property owner has posted the very specific 30.06 or 30.07 signs, not just the general 46.03 sign. If those specific signs aren't up, carrying might be legal for an LTC holder, even though it's listed as a prohibited place in 46.03.
It appears that way. The interplay between 46.03 and the specific notice statutes, 30.0630.07, is absolutely critical for licensed carriers to understand for those particular locations. The onus is heavily on the property owner to use the correct, specific signage to legally prohibit licensed carry in those instances.
Mind-bogglingly complex, but vital detail.
Absolutely. So we've really journeyed through an incredibly intricate legal landscape today, from just how specific the definitions of weapons are to the critical rules on who can possess or carry and that extensive list of prohibited locations.
Right.
And then we unpack that huge array of exceptions and non-applicability clauses, showing just how nuanced and incredibly context-dependent all these laws really are.
Yeah, what really stands out is the sheer density, the meticulous detail you need to navigate this area of law. It is definitely not about just common sense. It's about understanding precise legal terms, measurements, circumstances, even down to the type of sign on a door, like we just discussed. Hopefully, this deep dive has given you, our listeners, the tools to be truly well-informed and maybe a bit more confident in understanding this really crucial aspect of public safety and personal rights.
It's such a complex web, isn't it? Constantly being adjusted, trying to balance individual liberties with collective security, a balance that's always being debated.
It really is. And considering all this meticulous detail we've discussed, the numerous definitions, the exceptions piled on exceptions, it makes you wonder, doesn't it? What does this intense level of legal specificity tell us about society's ongoing attempt to strike that balance? And maybe more interestingly, how might future legal interpretations or even new technologies continue to challenge these boundaries that seem so carefully drawn today?
That's a really profound thought to leave everyone with as we continue to engage with and try to understand our legal landscape. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blast tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Four seasons greetings to you all from